Hey, welcome everybody. This is the fourth office hours session. Well, it's the office hours session for week four. I think we skipped last week because that was at Freedom Fest. And I have a Capri Sun emergency to deal with. Okay, now be careful. Don't squeeze it. All right. We got a 7-year-old Capri Sun and he's holding it over the couch. You know how you grab it and okay, volcano action. Okay, so this is the office hours for week four, and this is summer of 2012 session of Mises Academy class, Anatomy of the Fed, just in case this video gets misplaced and people want to know what the context is. Okay, so yeah, go ahead. We got about 7 of you guys logged in right now, so thank you for taking your Saturday morning to do this, and go ahead and just post your questions in the chat box. So Jan asks, in today's world, exactly what instruments play the role of money proper? What exactly are banks' capital reserves, on top of which they pyramid money substitutes? Also, does the U.S. dollar play the role of capital reserves for the rest of the world? Okay, so those are some good questions. Okay, sorry, just let it ring, Clark, don't worry about it. All right, so money, I think you're alluding to the fact that in standard Austrian discussion, they talk about money proper versus like broader monetary forms. So it doesn't exactly course, well, there's different things. Let me see if I can find it really quick. As I wrote an article for Mises.org one time on monetary aggregates, it might even be linked in the syllabus. I'm not sure. Let me see. Robert Murphy. I'm just Googling to see if I can get you guys the link. Maze of, I think it's called the Maze of Monetary Aggregates. Yeah. Okay, so if you're just listening to this and you want to go look it up, the article is called Lost in a Maze of Monetary Aggregates? And it's a Mises.org article I wrote or published on February 14th, 2011. So give it to your sweetheart. I'm sure this is a great thing to talk about at dinner. All right, so let me put, I'll post that link there. Okay, so if you're looking at the chat box, you can see the link. So there, I mean, for a fuller discussion, I go through there and talk about what current economists mean by things like, hey, Clark, you got to be quiet, buddy. Mean by things like monetary base, M1, M2, that kind of stuff. So that, a lot of those things overlaps a little bit with the standard Misesian way of looking at stuff, like the way he would lay it out in the theory of money and credit. So if you really want to see the hardcore, rigorous Misesian and then his followers adopted the framework approach to classifying different types of money, just go look at my study guide to theory of money and credit. And then that explains everything. For right now, let me just talk about it a little bit briefly to answer Jan's question somewhat. So remember, money is the commonly accepted medium of exchange, but then there's, and so that's what Mises means by money proper. So back in the day, that would have been actual gold and silver, if those were the actual money commodities. But then you've got banks to come along that have what we would call fractional reserve banking. What Mises would say is they issue fiduciary media. So here, actually I'm getting ahead of myself. Even if they have 100% reserves, there's a distinction between a perfectly secure immediate claim to the money commodity versus the money commodity itself. So Mises called those things money substitutes. And so, for example, a banknote. So if there's a bank, and this is back in the day, and you know the Cornwallis Bank issues banknotes, so pieces of paper that say the bearer of this note can go to any Cornwallis branch, turn it in, and upon demand get 1 ounce of gold, like the actual yellow metal and coin. That's the physical thing. And if the community starts to accept those paper notes as just as good as gold, because in practice, Cornwallis always redeems it promptly. There's never an issue of them turning people away. So the merchants start accepting those things at par. If I say accepts at par, I mean they don't do a discount. It's not like you have to have 10.5 ounces of gold in terms of the notes versus 10 in the physical coin, that merchants treat them equivalently. All right, so if that happens, then Mises is going to say those pieces of paper are performing the services of money. So that from an individual's point of view who's considering increasing his money balances, you know, how much money he wants to hold in equilibrium, all the reasons you would hold actual gold would apply to holding this piece of paper, because it does everything the money does. And as money, obviously you can't use it to make jewelry out of, but then you're talking about a commodity application. But in terms of gold's function as the commonly accepted medium of exchange, those pieces of paper do the same thing. So Mises says there's a sense in which those are money, what he would call in the broader sense. And so if we want to start talking about the total quantity of money and then what the effect would be on the prices of goods and services quoted in gold ounces, then it would matter. You would start counting that stuff too. So people are walking around with lots of these Cornwallis banknotes in their pocket and they're spending it, and that's pushing up prices in stores. Well, then that's, as a monetary theorist, you have to take it into account. Okay, so that's the distinction. And then, of course, if you have fraction reserve banking, or what Mises would call the issuance of fiduciary media, where Cornwallis Bank has more of those notes floating around than it has yellow metal in the vault, then the quantity of money in the broader sense is variable depending on what the banks do. The banks can increase the quantity of money in the broader sense, but they can't increase money proper, because money proper would mean the actual yellow metal. So only miners, or if like people take jewelry and melt it down and turn it into coins, that's the only way you could affect the supply of, or the quantity of money proper. But the quantity of money in the broader sense, Mises also, or the translations, they would also call it money in the narrower sense to refer to money proper. Okay, so, and the reason, now Jan, I know you asked me for modern times, so you might be wondering, yeah, I get that back then, but I wanted to make sure we refresh our memories of that distinction in the past, when you know, when it's clear cut, when there's commodity gold money versus paper banknotes. And it wouldn't just be paper banknotes, it would also be checkbook deposits. So if you went and put an ounce of gold in the bank, a physical ounce of gold, and then they gave you not a paper note that was generally acceptable, but instead they gave you a checkbook, and they said you have now an ounce on deposit, and you could write checks, then that also would count as money in the broader sense, but not money proper. Okay, so now you got that distinction. That still carries through to today. But now, what is money proper? It's not gold. It's, in the United States, it's the U.S. dollar, which is a fiat currency. Okay, so that's a little bit weird for some people to get sometimes. Now, and some people are going to argue and say, no, gold really is still the money, and then there's, well, gold should be money. I grant you that gold would be a better money, but in terms of the standard definition, a commonly accepted medium of exchange, it's clearly the U.S. dollar if you're talking about people who live in the United States, and it's the euro if you're talking about people who live in Europe. So maybe that doesn't mean it's a good money, and it doesn't mean it was spontaneously adopted, but that satisfies the definition. If you had to say what's the money right now in the United States, it's the U.S. dollar. if you try to pay your electric bill with gold, it's probably not going to work, but everyone's going to accept U.S. dollars. So, okay, so that, so the U.S. fiat dollar is money proper, and then money in the broader sense would still include checkbook deposits. So there's not, there are no longer banknotes in the sense that they, there used to be. So it used to be individual commercial banks could issue their own notes, and now that's been suppressed. That's one of the things that central banks typically would do, as Rothbard explained, is they would monopolize the issue of banknotes so that even when you were on a commodity money, only the central government through, you know, in conjunction with its central bank could issue pieces of paper that were claims on the money proper. So, but what central banks did not monopolize was the issuance of checkbook deposits. Okay, so this is a little bit weird, but the point is you can, there's a difference between having a $100 bill, you know, a Benjamin, a piece of paper that's got a picture of Benjamin Franklin, says $100 on it, and it says, you know, Federal Reserve note. That thing is more money. It's, you know, it's more of a bedrock money than if you put your ATM card into the, in, or you put your debit card into the ATM and you show somebody, hey, look, it, I have $100 on deposit with Citibank. All right, that, that the $100 bill is more secure, is more fundamentally money than the $100 that Citibank just says on its books you have on deposit with them, because they actually don't have a $100 bill with your name on it. And so so in today's economy, the money proper would be the dollar or the euro or whatever, and the broader money substitutes would be things like checkbook deposits. Now, where you get things get really tricky is stuff like and one last complication, which might throw some people, is a Federal Reserve note. You might think, okay, that's a banknote, and Murphy just told me that banknotes were not money proper. Well, but they are not, because if they're issued by the central bank and it's fiat currency. Okay, so originally, a Federal Reserve note was analogous to a commercial bank note, and it was just the Federal Reserve happened to be the one issuing this piece of paper that said you can still turn this in and get gold. Right, because the Fed was founded in 1913, the U.S. was still on a gold standard then. It was on the gold standard, the classical gold standard, up through 1933, and then it was even on the weird Bretton Woods system up through 1971. Okay, so Federal Reserve notes up until 1971 were actually claims on gold with varying degrees of eligibility, right, from 1933 to 71. You as a regular citizen couldn't do it, but other central banks still could turn in Federal Reserve notes and get gold. All right, so, but now the Federal Reserve note isn't a claim on anything. And but they still call it that. So that's the crazy thing about fiat currency is, well, it's not even the crazy thing about fiat currency, it's about our particular type of fiat currency. That, in other words, it still calls itself a note to maintain the historical continuity, because that's what they used to be called back when it actually was a note that was a claim on gold. But now it's not a claim on anything. So that's the one thing that might be confusing you, is when I say a bank note is not money proper, that doesn't apply to a situation where the central bank issues notes and it's fiat currency, because then technically that is the money proper, even though they're also banknotes. And then the last point is, if you've understood all that, the okay, yeah, Janet, okay, Don't worry, Jan. So Jan has a follow-up. He says, but in what form is the U.S. dollar money proper? The paper Fed notes, coins, reserves of the Fed? Yeah, that's just where I was coming at now. Okay, so legally speaking, it's clearly the paper currency, so green pieces of paper that have pictures of U.S. presidents and numbers on them and says this is U.S. Federal Reserve note. That's part of it. But also, commercial banks' reserves on deposit with the Fed. Legally speaking, those are considered equivalent to currency. And the reason, excuse me, is, and so again, it sounds like I'm contradicting myself, because before I was saying your checkbook balance with a commercial bank is not money proper. If you have $100 on reserve with Citibank, that you know you put deposit there with Citibank, that's not the same thing. That's not as much moneyness as if you have a $100 bill in your hand. However, if Citibank has $1 million on deposit with the Fed, so even though that money doesn't exist anywhere in paper form, just electronically, if the Federal Reserve says on our books, we acknowledge that Citibank, one of our clients, has an account with us and it has $1 million in its account, that is legally as much money as if Citibank had $1 million in actual currency, in green pieces of paper. And the reason is that because it's fiat currency, there's no legal restrictions. If the Fed wants to, it can just say to the Treasury, to the Bureau of Printing and Engraving, print up 1 million of these things, right? So if Citibank says to the Fed, we want to withdraw our money, you say we have $1 million on deposit with you, we want it currency, then there's nothing that could stop that. There's no problem that would arise. If it came down to it, the Fed would just tell the guys who literally run the printing press, fire it up, print up $1 million in currency, and we're going to give it to our client Citibank, and then you know they would hand them the green pieces of paper, and then on the Fed's books they would reduce Citibank's balance down to zero if it was originally $1 million. Okay, so that's why commercial bank reserves with the Fed are money proper, but you as an individual, you have a bank account with Citibank, and you think you've got $100 in there. That's not the same thing, because Citibank is not legally allowed to print money. So if you go to Citibank and say, give me my $100, and they only have 10 in the vault, then they can give you the 10 and say, sorry, we owe you 90 still, but we don't have it. And so that's the sense in which, you know, Mises made a distinction saying, so you see, we're going to call it money in the broader sense if you have a checkbook deposit, because clearly, in general, in normal times, the community treats it as equivalent to the money in the narrow sense, but they are different. And where you would see that difference manifest itself is if there's a bank run. But there can't be a bank run on the Fed. I mean, there could be a run on the Fed, but the Fed's not going to get in trouble because it can just print up money. Whereas on the gold standard, even the Fed would have been in that position. So I think institutionally, back in the days of the gold standard, I don't know how they would have done it at the time, how if you asked Austrian economists at the time, but I would not have classified commercial bank reserves with the Fed as money in the narrower sense on a gold standard, because then it still would have been the case if there was a bank run, the Fed can't create gold out of thin air. As far as coins, Jan, I'm not as sure about coins. Historically, coins were, I know historically in several countries, because Mises talks about this a lot in Theory of Money and Credit, coins were different. It's not worth me getting into right now, partly because I'm a little bit fuzzy on some of the details, but Mises was treating those things as different from other types of currency that the government would issue. And I'm not sure legally right now if there is a distinction. I mean, you're right, Jan, following up saying you can exchange coins for paper Fed notes. That's right, that's true. So you would think economically there's not a distinction. So yeah, my intuition would be to agree with you and to say, yeah, that whether you have a dollar bill or four quarters, it's the same thing, and so coins should count as part of the money proper. But like I say, it's I know historically there were distinctions. And it may be that the distinctions went back to the time when there was a gold or a silver standard. So like you could have coins that actually didn't have silver in them or didn't have much that were claims on actual silver. And so then there'd be that distinction. And if the government, you know, it might be a situation where the government wasn't legally obligated to exchange it, but in practice it was doing it. Or if it didn't have 100% reserves backing it up, if it was just like out of general tax funds, that the government maintained the redemption fund so that if people did want to turn in their loose change to get the actual silver or gold to which it was a claim, then it could do that. But in practice, so the point of having this the change was just so, you know, people could make change. And so there is the government, its role of maintaining the currency, did that as a service. And I just know back then there was a distinction legally and then also economically between different types, you know, the other forms of money that the government would issue and then the coins. But you're right, now if it's fiat and if the legal tender laws apply to coins as well as paper notes, it's probably the same thing. Okay. So like I said, with all this stuff, and then you also asked about bank reserves. I mean, you were calling them capital reserves. Just we already burned through half an hour here, so let me just say one last thing on that. Just be careful. There's a difference between banks' capital requirements and reserve requirements. And I don't know if you were mixing those up, Jan, or if you really meant the one versus the other. But and we'll get into this a little bit more, guys, in subsequent lectures. All right, so I'm just going to say very quickly right now, and if you want more details, if you just wait, when we start talking about conventional Fed operations, some of this will be clearer. But so there's regulations on let me just speak about the U.S. because that's what I know better. So there's regulations on the Fed has regulations on U.S. banks, and so as you guys probably all know, one of the things is there's a reserve requirement. So the banks, in theory at least, they have to have a certain amount of reserves of money proper, either currency in the vault or reserves with the Fed, backing up their outstanding demand deposits. So if their customers collectively have $1 billion in checking account balances with Citibank, then Citibank, let's say, needs to have, $10 million in reserves backing that up. And I'm just making that number up. That's not the real number. That would be a 10% reserve requirement. And so that's got to, you maybe have $8 million in currency in the vault and $2 million on deposit with the Fed. That would be a 1%. They would need $100 million. Sorry, I said $1 billion. Their customers have $1 billion in reserve in deposits. Citibank would need $100 million in reserves. Maybe it's got $80 million in cash and $20 million on deposit with the Fed. Okay. So then capital requirements are something different, and that goes back to the balance sheet stuff. So remember when we were walking through just the standard balance sheet operations, and I was talking about that thing called shareholder equity. So that's another name for capital. When you ask, you know, how much capital is in a business or something, it would be the shareholder equity in terms of that discussion. So the point is, on top of just that reserve requirement, the banks also have to have adequate capital requirements. And I don't know off the top of my head exactly what they are, but the point is, you know, if you're going to have so much in liabilities, then you have to have a certain amount of capital, you know, so that you're not so leveraged. And then on top of that, there's also regulations concerning the quality of that capital. So you can't just own a bunch of, you know, a stake in a hedge fund, because that's pretty risky. You have to have that capital consisting of assets that are meet certain requirements. But keep in mind, again, those capital requirements are different from the reserve requirements. So the connection is, if you had reserves, those are assets for the bank, and then when you're figuring out how much capital does the bank have, it's your assets minus your liabilities. And so, I mean, those, if the commercial bank has $80 million in currency in its vaults and its various branches, that's going to help with both requirements. In other words, that's going to partly satisfy the reserve requirements, and that $80 million in currency is an asset, so other things equal, that's going to raise the capital of the bank, and certainly having currency is a safe asset. But I'm just saying that capital requirements are a different regulation from reserve requirements. Okay, George Smith says, what did Keynes have to say about central banking? Did he consider it essential for his policies to work? Off the top of my head, I can't think of any specific passages or quotes about him saying that, but I mean, in the general theory, his big thing is all the different ways that the capitalist decentralized market economy can get into a rut, and all the different ways that the government would be able to pull it out, and then to prevent those things from happening again. He goes near the end, and people argue about what did Keynes really mean, but he talks about socializing investment and having the government, you know, the government overseeing investment instead of leaving it to the wheeler dealer capital markets, which Keynes likened to casinos. So, and of course, he also has that famous preface to the German edition that, again, people argue about what did Keynes mean, but he says something like, many of the ideas in this book would be easier to implement in a regime like what the Nazis are doing, and that, you know, couldn't be done so easily in a classical liberal framework or something. I forget the exact quote. So it doesn't mean Keynes was there saying, oh yeah, I'm a big fan of Hitler, but it does mean he was acknowledging that a lot of his solutions were top-down central planning type solutions and or interventions, and that you could do that much more easily in a centralized framework if there was a strong government that had those kind of powers to be able to use them when Keynes thought the economy required it. So, like I say, off the top of my head, I can't think of Keynes calling for a central bank the way that in the Communist Manifesto, I think one of the planks is they call for a central bank, if I'm not mistaken. And so I don't know if there's something analogous to that in the general theory, but I would be stunned if Keynes didn't think a central bank was necessary to steer an economy. Okay. Let's see. And I think, unfortunately, we're hitting the problem where people are posting news stuff and it's bouncing around on me. Okay, Devesh says, you mentioned in your last lecture that some Austrian economists, including yourself, could call the collapse of the housing bubble. Do you have an opinion on the road ahead, collapse of the sovereign debt bubble, banking crisis, etc.? Or do you know of any other Austrian economist who has attempted to predict the road ahead? Do you have any link to such articles? Do you think economics in general, and Austrian economics in particular, lends itself to be able to make such predictions? Okay, great question. So let me just talk a little bit about that. So I have to be humble myself on this thing because I thought we were going to have price inflation that was larger than we've had thus far. So when Bernanke started doing all his stuff in 2008, I was one of the people that was, you know, beating the drums early on saying, whoa, this is crazy. Look at these charts of what Bernanke's doing. This is nuts. In conjunction with all the other anti-growth policies that the federal government's putting in place, this is a recipe for rising prices because I thought, you know, real output's going to collapse. At the same time, they're dumping way more money into the system. So smaller real output, larger stockpile of money, surely that's going to make the money price per unit of output go up. Well, I mean, and there's lots of different ways we can talk about that. I mean, you did see commodity prices zoom way up in response to quantitative easing. And, you know, and in retrospect, things actually do kind of make sense that if you have massive unemployment and no hope in sight, you're going to have consumers being very tight with their money. And then the money that Bernanke dumped into the system actually went into the pockets of rich bankers primarily. It wasn't like he just dropped it from a helicopter. And so in that world, if you think, okay, the final consumer is still struggling, but there's a lot of capitalists now who have an extra $1 trillion to play with, what would happen? It actually kind of makes sense that you would see commodity prices zoom up and other inflation hedges, but you wouldn't see the price of bread necessarily go through the roof or milk go through the roof. In other words, the guys running hedge funds and stuff who have access to that money that Bernanke pumped in, they're not going to go invest in milk and bread and tuna fish. They're going to go invest in gold and silver and, you know, just like general commodity indexes maybe. And that is what you saw go up. Okay, but nonetheless, hindsight's 2020. At the time, I was worried about massive price inflation. So I am not the best person to be talking about how great Austrians were for predicting things because I kind of publicly stuck my neck out and was one of the ones. I never used the term hyperinflation. Now, even telling, you know, saying like Mark Faber was throwing that word around, and I was saying, well, come on, we're not going to have hyperinflation. But anyway, the point is, I thought we were going to have more inflation, price inflation than we did. So there's that issue. As far as the housing bubble, though, we did talk about why using Austrian business cycle theory and looking what happened with interest rates. It looked like there was going to be a big crash. So, unfortunately, what that means, if you want to use the same approach and say, well, it seemed to work for the housing bubble, is it working now? Well, what it would mean is we're being set up now for a much, much bigger crash. Because what Bernanke has done with interest rates and monetary policy dwarfs what Bernanke did. And what's weird is, you almost hesitate to say that because it seems odd to describe what we're in right now is a boom, right? In other words, if that's true, what I just said, if that's true, it means right now we're in a bigger bubble than we were in during the housing bubble years. And that seems like an odd thing to say because it doesn't feel like we're in a bubble, does it? It feels like we're in the midst of the Depression. And so, you know, if everybody, we had tons of prosperity right now and unemployment were 2% and everybody was buying all kinds of stuff on credit and the standard of living was really high and rising a lot from year to year, and we were pointing at all the stuff Bernanke was doing and said, this is artificial, this is all going to come crashing down, that would be a very comfortable thing to say. But it seems weird to say right now when unemployment's so high and everybody's just miserable and our standard of living in terms of some measures, you know, has been stagnant, at least for pockets of the population, for years, it seems weird to say, oh, this is all artificial prosperity, this is all going to come crashing down because this is all just built up by Bernanke. So I'm not... So clearly, let me put it this way. Clearly, I think what Bernanke has been doing has been preventing the economy from recalibrating itself, right? That there was a needed correction because of the malinvestments of the housing bubble years, and if the government and the Fed had just stood back and let everything collapse in 2007 or 2008, it would have been awful for 6 months. But then I think they would have hit rock bottom, and then it would have paved the way for a solid recovery. And at this point, it would just be a bad, distant memory, and everything would be fine. We'd be back to normal. We'd be humming along. So I do think that what Bernanke has done is partly an explanation for why we're stuck in this rut and why it seems like we're not getting out of it. And to say, but then when you say, okay, but is it like there's a ticking time bomb, and the longer we keep doing this, the deeper the hole we're eventually that we're digging ourselves into, and it's, at some point it's going to be obvious, even though right now not many people can see it. If you're forcing me to answer that, then yeah, I think the answer is yes. That I do think the structure of production is still all screwed up, and that every month that passes with interest rates being held this low, I think that just rearranges or puts it into disarray even more. So I do think so. And then, like you say, when you say, okay, but where's the bubble? I think it's in sovereign debt. That if Bernanke sold off the trillion plus in government debt that the Fed is holding, I think interest rates on government debt would go up. I think that would set in motion a chain reaction. I think lots of other people would panic and they would start dumping it. I think the dollar would crash. And then, yeah, the U.S. would go into a depression that would make the Great Depression look like child's play. All right, so that's true, but that's my view. But how does that play out in terms of, you know, what's going to happen? Well, I doubt Bernanke's going to dump $1 trillion in Treasury securities tomorrow. So, you know, it's hard to say, because I think one of the things going on here is a lot of the investment world doesn't see things like the Austrians do. And so that was partly why I was so sure you'd get price inflation, is I thought, surely as we keep getting deeper and deeper into this, and they keep running bigger deficits, and they keep bailing out the banks, and the Fed and the ECB just keep printing up more and more money electronically to just keep throwing at the problem, and it keeps just buying us shorter and shorter margins of safety. I mean, like with the ECB bailing out countries and banks and stuff in Europe, it used to be when they would announce a new bailout package, the markets would be settled for like a few months before the crisis would return. But now it's like they'll announce some new thing and the markets will be settled for 48 hours, right? So I thought people would see this earlier and they would realize creating money out of thin air doesn't solve the problem, but they still don't see that, and people still keep saying, I mean, it's amazing to me that Paul Krugman and guys like that, and even Scott Sumner, like, so-called right-wingers, just keep saying, oh, well, you know, geez, the Germans are so silly. Why don't they just let the ECB print more money just to fix things over there? And so if and when Europe does come crashing down, there's going to be a large segment of the blogosphere and punditry who are going to say, see, you guys didn't print enough money. We've been telling you to print money, even though by any objective measure, the Fed and the ECB have been creating more money now than they ever did in any previous crisis in world history. So it's a phenomenal PR job they've done, but they've actually got people thinking that the reason Europe is in trouble right now is that they've been too timid in running budget deficits and printing money. It's astonishing that that's where mainstream economic punditry has gone. And even like fairly free market guys in general kind of buy into that now. And they say, oh yeah, well, it does seem like austerity's not worth, like they've got austerity over there. So anyway, I'm kind of straying from your question, but what I'm trying to say is the timing, I have no idea. So yeah, the general economic environment, to me, if Austrian economics makes any sense, it can't possibly be the case that what Bernanke and these other guys have been doing for the last 4 years is good. And moreover, I would be surprised if it's not going to really blow up in our faces. Like, in other words, if they could do all this stuff and all it means is, oh yeah, we kind of had a really miserable economy for a few years, and then we gradually grow out of it, and then the Fed's holdings shrink back to a more normal level, and there's no massive price inflation, we kind of just get out of it gradually, just gradually unwind everything. If they do that, then I really need to rethink my views of the economy. Because if you had told me 10 years ago, could Bernanke do all this, or I wouldn't have known who Bernanke was, could a central banker do all this stuff and it not totally screw up the economy, like I wouldn't have thought that would be possible. So I don't know if I'm answering your question, but I do think that, the way I think it's going to play out is the euro is going to, something's going to happen with the euro first, whether that means it just collapses and then different countries break off from it, and some countries, you know, go down and other ones are okay, like Germany would probably be fine, switching over back to the mark. Or if the ECB just says, let's just do it, and they just fire up the printing presses and bail everybody out with an unlimited backstop of printing money so that the way they solve the problem is just have massive price inflation and the middle class gets wiped out and everybody's retirement savings get reduced to nothing, but at least the governments don't default on their obligations and the bankers get paid off and everything. That's another way they could do it that would also be awful, but I could see that happening. And then I think that that's eventually going to happen to the dollar, that there's going to be a crisis with the dollar similar to what's happening with the euro now. But it's hitting the euro first because the euro is not as strong as the dollar, and because just the institutional factors over there, there are various reasons I think the crisis came to Europe first. But the type of thing that's happening with the euro, I think, will happen with the dollar. And it's just so that the U.S. has a lot more prestige, and I guess we have a bigger margin to play with. But, I mean, if you look at the figures I don't know if you guys have heard of this term called the fiscal cliff, where at the end of this year, tax rates are scheduled to go up and spending cuts are supposed, I mean, it's, I think the U.S. government has a shorter and shorter window before stuff really gets crazy. But again, I'm timid to throw out a time frame because I thought it would have already happened by now, and it hasn't. So I'm not sure how long they can keep the charade going. Okay. Brad Skiles says, what is the Keynesian view of how the Fed began? We're studying the sound money view, which is clandestine. What is typically taught? Well, Brad, I don't know. If you read John Kenneth Galbraith or something, you know, he's got some stuff on some monetary history. I don't know what he says about this era. I would like to think a Keynesian or a mainstream economist in general who does the historical research knows that there were some sinister players involved. Because, I mean, you could still tell the story and say, oh, yeah, there were some private bankers who tried to hijack the Fed and whatever and form it for their own ends. And that's why now that we have this institution, we just have to be really vigilant about making sure it's conducted according to sound public policy and doesn't get captured by special interest, right? Just like if you a so-called progressive intellectual surely understands that when Republicans are in office, regulatory agencies of the federal government don't do things in the public interest, and they just do things to favor big businesses who are paying them off, or you know, who have lucrative sweetheart deals and that kind of stuff. So it's not like that's a libertarian only idea. But the thing is, the progressives then don't conclude from that observation or that realization that, oh, gee, maybe we should shut down these government agencies because they're always going to get captured by big corporate interests and do things to favor them and to lock out competitors. No, the progressive says, well, that's why we need to have an anti-corruption bill. We need to clean house. We need to elect the right people to make sure that they staff these agencies with people like me who are clean and, you know, noble and pure, and all I have in mind is the public interest at heart. So have me be in charge of the FDA, and I'm going to be, you know, I'm going to play hardball with these pharmaceutical companies. Have me be in charge of the SEC, and I'm not going to look the other way when Madoff's running a Ponzi scheme, the way the SEC in real life did look the other way because Madoff was advising the SEC. I don't know if you guys know that. Part of the reason Bernie Madoff survived so long, even though guys in the private sector were literally writing letters to the SEC saying this guy Madoff is running a Ponzi scheme. We've looked at his prospectus. There's no way these numbers can be accurate. The only way he can be reporting these earnings with the strategy he says he's using as if it's a Ponzi scheme. So you should look into this. For years, and the SEC did nothing. And part of why they did nothing was because Madoff and his family was advising the SEC, like they were buddies with them. It wasn't just like they were incompetent. They actually thought he was a great guy. So my point, Brad, is it wouldn't surprise me if somebody who actually did research and was coming from like a Keynesian perspective knew the sordid history of the actual founding of the Federal Reserve, but then just said, well, that's in the past. We can't change what happened back then. But what we can say now is people are hurting. We need more monetary stimulus, and so that's what the Fed should do. Like, it's not going to help unemployed workers right now to abolish the Fed just because 100 years ago some rich bankers had some ulterior motives in founding it. I think that's what they would say. Just like, I mean, there's crazy stuff, like looking into the history of, like, Planned Parenthood and stuff like that. Like, if you, you know, but a progressive today is either just not going to worry about that or is going to say, well, okay, but I can't control what happened in the past. The thing is, right now, it's an organization that has the ability to do a lot of good. And so let's harness it for that. Okay, we got about 5 minutes left. Let's see. Jan says, my former Keynesian professor says a return to the gold standard is nonsense because our central bank, and Jan's writing from Czechoslovakia, the Czech Republic, owns no physical gold. And I was just recently in Slovakia, so I should really know about the distinction. Okay. So my former Keynesian professor says return to the gold standard is nonsense because the Czech central bank owns no physical gold. He says, quote, considering today's market prices of gold, we would need thousands of tons of gold to go to back up the stock of paper money we have today, end quote. Is he right? Okay, this is let me say one more thing because I see George Smith asking about forecasting. So, yeah, in general, Austrian economists should be very humble and say, hey, we acknowledge more than any other school of thought that people, you know, they make subjective decisions and that you can't use a mathematical model to predict what human beings are going to do. And so Austrians, more than any other school, should be very humble about predicting things in the future. But still, part of the reason we study Austrian economics is we think it helps us understand the world. And so in terms of making qualitative views, like, I mean, strictly speaking, all we can say is Bernanke doing the stuff he was going to do is going to make the economy more volatile or less prosperous than it otherwise would be. If aliens showed up tomorrow and gave us some new technology, then maybe we would end up being far richer in 2013 than we would have been, you know, in an alternate, than people would have thought. But then we would just say as Austrians, well, we would have been even richer still if Bernanke hadn't been doing his crazy stuff and then the aliens showed up, right? So there's that kind of issue where technically all you're ever able to really do is say relative to what otherwise would have happened, you can't actually make specific predictions about absolute conditions. Okay, so we've got 2 minutes left. Back to me to answer Jan's question. Okay, so, yeah, so the problem is, let me talk about the U.S. because I know those numbers a little bit better. So the issue is, suppose we wanted to have the dollar go back to gold, tie the dollar back to gold, how would you do it? Well, the problem is, what price would you use? So does anyone know the gold price right now? Is it like $1,600 an ounce, something like that? $1,700? Yeah, I haven't looked at it too recently, but it's $1,600, $1,700. Okay, so the issue is, you can figure out how many U.S. dollars are out there, and then also, too, you have to figure out, what are we backing up? Are we backing up money proper? Are we saying for every, you know, probably what you mean is the federal government or the Fed is going to say, if you come in and give us currency, or if you're a commercial bank and you have deposits with us, we will redeem them for such and such amount of gold, physical gold. So, you know, if you wrote a check from your Citibank account, it would only have to be like if it cashed the check, if the check cleared. Okay, so so that's one thing you got to do. And then the question is, what's the exchange rate? What's the peg, if you will, or what's the amount? So, because back in 1971, it was $35 an ounce. And so, do you go back to that point? Because if you did that, the Fed would need a ton of gold. I mean, not a ton. It would need many tons of gold, right? In other words, if someone could just go to the Fed would effectively be saying, if you give us $35, we'll give you an ounce of gold. So that would, you can see it, that would be a pretty stupid thing for the Fed to do, because then they would need to somehow get a bunch of gold that they would have to be paying. George says right now it's $1,584 an ounce for, and then selling it to people for $35. That's not a good way to make money. All right, so there's that issue. The issue then, though, is, well, what if, even if you just wanted to lock it in, what seems natural is to say, let's lock it into the current market price. So the Fed says, okay, right now gold is trading at $1,584 per ounce. We're just going to lock that in stone. Boom. So from now on, for the rest of time, somebody hands us $1,584 in U.S. paper currency, we will give you a physical ounce of gold. So there's that issue. So you could do that, but then the problem is still, if you want 100% reserves, what you do is you take the total amount of dollars outstanding and divide by 1584, and then that's how many ounces of gold the Fed needs to have in its vault. And right now it doesn't have that many ounces in its vault, so what does it do? So what I've said in the past is, so Jan, one thing is to say you could go back on a gold standard without it being 100% reserves. In other words, they could just have a buffer of gold stockpiled and then just use that to enforce the new peg. Just like some currency boards and things, I don't think are 100% reserve. You know, like when one country ties its fiat currency to some other country's fiat currency, they don't necessarily have 100% reserves to be able to back that up so that if speculators turned in unlimited quantities of their own country's currency, at some point they would run out of the reserves of the other country's currency and they'd have to drop the peg. So there's that aspect to it, that the Fed could just be, you know, targeting the price of gold and not have 100% reserves and just try to, you know, keep speculators from thinking the peg's not going to last and attacking it. And then over time, they could start building up the reserves. So I have a proposal in my book, How Privatized Banking Really Works. I'm not going to go look, because we're running out of time here. I got to shut this down. But if you just Google Murphy, How Privatized Banking Really Works, and get that, there's a whole section in there where I talk about how you could move back to how you could do it. So Jan, you're right. They don't have it right now, but I'm saying what they could do is they could just start selling off their current assets and replacing them with gold. And then Kay has just posted also. So I would read it in two parts. First, I think you should read the discussion in my book, How Privatized Banking Really Works, and you'll see I had some problems. And then read this new article that Kay just posted, My Mises Daily, saying putting the country back on gold, because then I saw Mises' proposal in Theory of Money and Credit, and I realized his idea was better than mine. But I think if you're really interested in this and want to get the full effect, you should read my discussion on how privatized banking really works first, and see some of the problems that I bumped into, and I kind of just waved my hand and said, well, yeah, this is a problem, but I don't know what to do about it. And then reading Mises, it was like, oh, that's what you do about it. But Mises, I think, do it in that order if you really want to see the issues. Okay, well, thanks, guys, for tuning in, and we got to shut this down now. So I will see you on Monday, where I'm going to be broadcasting from Auburn, because I'll be down there for Mises U.